A Waikato Thing, Episode 4, Earthquake.
So if you have friends or somebody visiting and they haven't experienced earthquakes, they may well ask you, you know, what is an earthquake? And simply, an earthquake is a rock being broken. The rock is having stress applied to it, it's been bent, and ultimately it fails and breaks. I'm Brad Scott, I'm a volcanologist, and currently I work with GNS Science. One of the best analogies I can think of is like the plastic ruler sitting on your desk, the 300mm ruler. That behaves elastically, it can bend. If you bend it too far, it'll snap. And that snapping is the earthquake. Now, the sizes of earthquakes that we have really depends on how big a piece of material is breaking. So if we think about an inch by inch piece of timber, that sort of snaps when you bend it. You've got to bend a 2x2 piece of timber a lot further. You've got to apply a lot more stress to break that, but it ultimately breaks. And you can go right up to a piece of 8x8 or a piece of 12x12. And those are sort of like your magnitude 2s, magnitude 3s, through to magnitude 6 or 7 earthquakes, just depending on the size of what's been broken.
The Earth's crust is made up of many tectonic plates, and these tectonic plates are continually moving. You can think about them as a puzzle, and all these pieces of the puzzle need to fit in with each other. Hi, I'm Whitney, and I am the Regional Resilience Specialist at the Waikato Regional Council. I specialise in natural hazard risk. The reason why these puzzle pieces move, or our tectonic plates move, is because of energy within the Earth's core. The Earth's core is very hot, and this heats up the mantle around the core, which is underneath the Earth's crust. You can think about this as if you're boiling a pot of water on the stove. Slowly, as the temperature of the water begins to heat up, you see these bubbles pop up, and you begin to see the circulation of energy moving around the pot. That is the exact same process that is happening within the mantle, within our Earth. And this is what causes our plate tectonics to move.
You'll hear people talking about the Pacific Australian plate boundary or the Hickarangi margin. Has many, many names. As scientists, we're very good at giving multiple names to the same feature.
In New Zealand, the plate boundary runs from the east coast of the North Island, down the east coast of New Zealand past Gisborne and Hawke's Bay, then enters the South Island near Kaikoura, and then goes down the Southern Alps, and then comes out the west side of the South Island. That is our tectonic plate boundary in New Zealand.
The Australian plate moves north, the Pacific plate's coming in east-west. As it moves north, it stretches the Rotorua Taupo area, and that stretching creates what we call rifting, and that's when the country is widened. The Rotorua Taupo area is widening about 1 centimetre a year, and the area in between is subsiding about the same rate. So we have superimposed across the Taupo volcanic zone what we call the Taupo Rift. So we have lots and lots of faulting, and we have lots of earthquakes, many, many earthquakes per year. And the rifting is capable of generating earthquakes sort of in the magnitude 6, magnitude 6.5, possibly as much as magnitude 7. The Edgecombe earthquake in 1987 is an example of those rifting earthquakes. And during that earthquake, the ground deformation, we had about 1.2 metres of east-west extension across the rift. So the distance between Tauranga and Whakatane increased by 1.2 metres. And the area in the middle of the rift around Edgecombe, that subsided up to 3 metres.
So along our plate boundary, we have the Pacific tectonic plate going underneath the Australian tectonic plate. As the Pacific plate goes down into the mantle, it is kind of trapping and pulling the Australian plate at the same time, and this causes the Australian plate to bulge. As the bulging occurs, we get extension, which causes earthquakes or fault lines to occur in places like the Waikato. So what does that mean for the Waikato region? It means we have fault lines in the Waikato region which can rupture. We have the Ketapehi fault line, which runs through the middle of the Hauraki drift. And we have the Wairoa fault, which is up by Pukekohe. And then we also have the Taupo volcanic zone and all the fault lines associated with volcanism down by Taupo. If a fault line ruptures within the Waikato region, depending on how close you are to that fault line, will determine how much ground shaking you feel. However, we can also feel ground shaking from earthquakes that have ruptured outside of our region, such as if the Hikarangi subduction zone went off, we will very likely feel ground shaking. And even if the Alpine fault goes off in the middle of the South Island, we will most likely also feel ground shaking from that. During the Kaikoura Hiranui 2016 earthquake event, a lot of people in the Waikato felt that.
I remember the Kaikoura earthquake waking up and with the house shaking, but also then hearing our pool sloshing from side to side as well. And we had a mini tsunami or seizure within our pool. So my name is Rick. I am the Regional Resilience Lead at Waikato Regional Council. That's what happens in the Waikato area, but it differs. And we know that within the Waikato Basin and also in the Hauraki Plains, the geology is such that the seismic wave, the seismic energy, wherever it is originating from, gets amplified. And so we feel that shaking a lot more. And so that energy is transferred in a way that it can impact our infrastructure and can impact our buildings. So we need to be quite aware of that. But we've also got potential seismic risk and earthquake epicentres within the Waikato area. One of the more common ones that people talk about is the Kirapehi fault line, which runs through the Hauraki Plains and underneath the Firth of Thames and out through the Hauraki Gulf. So that's one of the more active or known active faults that we have. And we had our last major earthquake that we had was back in 1972, just outside of Te Araha. Not a lot of damage, but it was felt, and it was reasonably significant for that area. Last year, back in 2023 in February, we had again the Te Araha, the Kirapehi fault went off. We had an earthquake, and the epicenter was just outside Waitoa, sort of between Waitoa and Te Araha. Now, it wasn't a big earthquake by sort of national international standards, but it was felt, and I think when people do feel an earthquake, and as New Zealanders we know very very well the potential impacts of an earthquake with Kaikoura and Christchurch as well. What we try to do and in collaboration with our colleagues in our research institutes, whether they be in a university or through our Crown Research Institutes, is we do need to understand our seismic risk and probability of a seismic event for the Waikato region. Now, interestingly, if you were to go online, and you can do this, to see, well, where are the fault lines within the Waikato region? And one thing for me that really, really stands out is what's not there. And if you look at, we are called the Shaky Islands, and you look at where around the country, and particularly in the North Island, where there are, looks like, a lot of active fault lines around the Waikato area, but none identified, or very few identified, in the Waikato area. And you might think, oh, that's quite lucky, we don't seem to have a very high seismic risk because, there's no fault lines there. But the only reason they're not mapped is because there still needs to be more research and more understanding around where those faults are, because some of these are hidden. And even just recently, in 2024, end of 2023, so GNS have been doing some investigation just outside of Morrinsville.
We've more recently been working on the Te Pinunga Fault, which is very close to Morrinsville. My name is Kate Clark. I'm an earthquake geologist at GNS Science. The Kirapehi Fault has been known about for quite a long time. That's quite a significant fault. When you look at maps of the region, you can see those fault scarps very prominently. A scarp is a step in the landscape where one side is higher than the other side, much like a riverbank where you've got the stream and then you step up onto the land and you've got a scarp there between the river and the land. The Te Pinunga Fault we only recently discovered, and it was only discovered because we looked at LIDAR data, which LIDAR data is very high resolution topographic maps of the region. So when you looked at these really high resolution topographic maps, you could start to see these very subtle scarps, sort of lineations running through the landscapes. And when you could see that, you could start to see that there were, there were all these fault lines. And the Tepeninga Fault is a very kind of messy, complex fault. It's not one long straight line, like you might imagine. You might be familiar with other faults like the Alpine Fault or the San Andreas Fault, where it's a really long straight line, just one big sort of gash through the landscape. The Tepeninga Fault is sort of about 10 to 15 scarps that are all sort of semi-parallel with each other. They run for a few kilometres and then peter out, and they might step over and start again somewhere else. So it's kind of a complex fault zone. We wanted to understand more about it. We wanted to understand how active it is, like how often it has earthquakes, how large are these earthquakes, and what would be the impact of these earthquakes to the Waikato region and to people living nearby, for example, in Morrinsville. To do this, we started a study. It was myself, Pilar Villamore at GNS was leading this. It was collaborative with the University of Waikato as well. And our main method of studying the Tepeninga Fault has been firstly mapping it, so using that LIDAR data to do really high-resolution mapping, figuring out where the fault goes. And then we went to the fault, and we tried to find locations where we could dig trenches across it. So a paleoseismic trench is where we get a large excavator in, and we use that to dig basically a ditch or a large hole, sort of 20 to 30 metres long, 3 to 4 metres deep, about, they're usually about 5 metres wide, and we dig that across the fault line. And what we're trying to do is expose the actual fault line and where it's offset layers of the earth. So what this achieves is, first of all, we can verify that the scarp we identify is indeed a fault line, because you can get them formed by other processes. So first of all, we wanted to know, are these lineations and scarps we see through the landscape, are they faults? So digging a trench and seeing a fault line verifies that it is indeed a fault line. We wanted to understand when it last had an earthquake. So was it, did it last rupture, you know, a few hundred years ago, or a few thousands of years ago, or tens of thousands of years ago? So to do that, we look at where the fault line has offset layers of the earth, and then we date those layers of the earth. So we get the age of those layers of dirt in the trench. And from that, we can work out approximately when the last earthquake was. We can look at earthquakes older than the last earthquake. So ideally, in a trench, we get a record of 2 or 3 past earthquakes. And that gives us the recurrence interval of the fault. So that's how often the fault ruptures. The combination of knowing the recurrence interval and knowing sort of the length of the fault, from that we can get information about the size of the earthquakes that could occur on that fault line. So that's what we're trying to understand with these fault studies on the Tepeninga at the moment. In the past, we've done these types of studies on the Kerepehi Fault. We're trying to understand how often and how big the earthquakes are, and some of the effects, like how much is the land going to be offset? Is it going to be 0.5 metre or, 3 to 5 metres? In some of the Tepeninga Fault trenches, it was really interesting because we saw evidence of liquefaction as well. You could see that in the trench. Like if you think of Christchurch after the earthquakes there, you had all the silt bubbling up to the surface, and the surface of the land was covered in silt. You can see the geological record of that liquefaction in some of these Tepeninga trenches. So when that fault's ruptured, it's not only caused movement of the land where one side of the fault has gone up relative to the other, but also you had liquefaction in these areas where silt was moving up from below and coming up to the surface.
A great way to visualise liquefaction is if you go to the beach and the tide is out, and you go put your feet in the wet sand, and you move around and you wobble around, and all of a sudden your feet sink. This is also a process of liquefaction. People in the Waikato community might not think that the Waikato could have liquefaction, but Christchurch also had sand that could be liquefied, a high water level in the groundwater, and earthquake sources to cause ground shaking, and that caused liquefaction there. And the Waikato region has the exact same thing. So we could really have a similar impact to what Christchurch had during the 2010 and 2011 earthquake sequence. Liquefaction is the ejection of material from underneath the ground to on top of the ground. Kind of like a volcano, a mini volcano of sediment being ejected from underneath the ground. The recipe for liquefaction is ground shaking, sediment which can be moved by energy, so typically sand, and a high water table, groundwater. In the Waikato region, particularly in the lower Waikato and the Hauraki Plains, we have all three of these. So if intense ground shaking occurred in the Waikato region, it's very likely that we will see liquefaction in these locations. And on the hazards portal, you can go into the earthquake tab and you can find a map which shows locations around the region which may experience liquefaction.
Tūterangi e tū, tū te papa e takoto. Tū ia rātou ko wehe ki te pō uriuri, ki te pō tangotango, ki te pō e o tia tū ai. Ko Rāhui Papa tōku ingoa. Rāhui Papa is my name. Part and parcel of our history is about the tupuna ruaumoko, or as some of our ancestors called him, Ruaimoko. Now, Ruaimoko was the unborn child of Papa Tuanuku that rested still and rests still in her womb, and every now and again turns over as a baby does when they kick, when they move around and there's motions and movements. One of our greatest stories about Te Ruu Whenua, or the shaking of the land, the earthquake activity, is about Taupiri when she grew up with her close relation Tongariro in the Central Plateau, and then moved away to marry a man closer to the sea. There is a number of stories about Pirongia marrying Taupiri and the children of the Hakarimata Range. And so all these stories are about whakapapa interconnectedness. Taupiri came and became unwell. And so she sent her servant to Tongariro to get the healing waters of the Central Plateau. The healing waters were, so Tongariro hit a rock at the base of Ruapehu and formed the Waikato Iti that empties out into the Tongariro River, that empties out into the volcanic cone of Taupo Nui Atia and makes her way up to up the Waikato channels. And so there was an idea about the river going around Lake or Haukuri and places like that, and then coming back onto the main route, but then emptying out through the Piarere Channel into the Hauraki rather than coming to the feet of Taupiri. And so there was some concern about those healing waters not actually arriving at Taupiri. So she raised her karakia, she raised her takutaku into the ear. Tongariro heard it, and their karakias joined together and became one. And that stirred Ruaumoko to make some movements in the belly of his mother. And it was that earthquake type situation that Ruaumoko rolled over, and then the valleys became different, and the water actually went on another pathway and ended up at the feet of Taupiri. One of the things we know is that there's quite a swift current in the Waikato until you get just past Taupiri, where it settles right down as it makes its way, it makes her way to the sea. We believe that Waikato is the symbol of virility, the symbol of fertility. So a female element is the Waikato River. That's, and then, of course, we talked about the ancestor or the giant Matahō, who lived around in the south of Auckland, who was a giant. And wherever he stepped, that caused new occurrences within the land. And our old people would justify that kōrero by saying that was earthquake activity that changed the contours of the land, that changed the way that the moana or the harbours would interact with the land. And so the earthquake activity was a key and core story, really, in the DNA and the whakapapa, the ancestry of the Waikato people. The naming conventions of traditional Māori were about naming them for events to be able to hold the story or the pūrākau of that particular area. And so Waikato, for example, is about plucking the water. And when you do that, and when you tell the story of Hoturoa, and then Ngāti Wairere have a version about the plucking of the water and the history of that name, it becomes just that little bit more clearer. Every name of every peak, every name of every landmass, every name of every stream and river has a story that goes with it. Every place name, every street name, every ancestor name has a story that goes with that name. And those are absolutely shrouded in the pūrākau that goes with that name. And so it's about telling that story to keep the living memory of those names alive.
Within the building code, there has actually been an update in 2019 to accommodate liquefaction in building property. If you're wondering what you can do to protect yourself from liquefaction, the building code already has built standards into it to ensure that homes and buildings are built to accommodate liquefaction. This doesn't mean that when liquefaction occurs, your building will be completely fine. Stuff may be impacted and your building may be damaged. It just means that it is not damaged as much as what it could have been.
New Zealand is well mitigated for the earthquake hazard. We recognised, you know, post the Napier earthquake that we needed a building code and we needed to do things. So our buildings are designed for us to survive the earthquake. They're not necessarily designed to be reoccupied, but they're designed for us to, you know, survive the earthquake, you know, hence the drop cover and hold for protecting yourself when you're in the building.
The building code also does provide guidance on how you can build earthquake-proof homes or buildings. Wood is a really good use of material because wood absorbs energy compared to concrete or steel, which resists energy. So you will always find concrete that is cracked during an earthquake. However, wood absorbs it, so they typically don't crack. So that's why homes in New Zealand are typically built from wood.
If we do get a seismic event, it can have some quite significant impacts.
If the Tipanunga Fault were to rupture today, what we'll see in the landscape, firstly, is a number of those fault strands are likely to move, so there will be breaks in the land surfaces. Fortunately, most of the land is rural, so it doesn't go through any major towns. It's unlikely it will go through the sort of foundations of any houses. It's likely to break any water lines crossing the fault, also likely to damage electricity infrastructure, also any telecommunication lines crossing the fault are likely to be broken by that. The roads will certainly be broken. That's probably going to be the most visual thing you'll see. You'll see the roads have been broken. You cannot drive across them. Suddenly there'll be a 1 metre step on the road. What the other main effects, you may get liquefaction in areas. People will feel the strong ground shaking. It will be most intense very close to the fault. So in that area near Morrinsville, Te Araha, you will also get relatively strong shaking in Hamilton and Cambridge. It will be felt in Auckland for sure, but probably not damaging shaking up there. But the shaking in the nearer area, sort of Morrinsville, Matamata, Te Araha, Hamilton, likely to be damaging shaking, damaging to buildings.
The only reason why we have communities thriving in the Hauraki Plains is because of the flood protection and land drainage infrastructure we have. And that's all been designed based on the current lay of the land and current elevations. And as the name suggests, Hauraki Plains, it's generally flat, but there is contour. There are, you know, changes in elevation there, which we need to be cognizant about. But because it's so flat and because it's very, very low topography, any even slight change in elevation can cause water to flow a different way. and perhaps away from a floodgate, away from a pump station that is designed to get the water out of the plains land and into our rivers. So if you have a seismic event, it's not just the immediate shaking, it's then the impact potentially on our flood protection system. And remember, you know, the Hauraki Plains is so low that a lot of the plains are actually below sea level, below mean high water spring, which is your sort of average of your high tides, your higher tides. And so if it had a significant breach or failure of our stop banks due to a seismic event, is that twice a day, potentially, the Hauraki Plains will get inundated, and inundated with salt water.
New Zealand has a lot of geological hazards. Traditionally people think about the tsunami, volcano and earthquake. The other hazard in New Zealand is landslide, and that can be a byproduct of two or three sources or agencies. We can have landslides generated by earthquakes, and we can equally have landslides generated by climate events. So you will encounter landslides, and they may have just come down because of heavy rainfall, or they may have been shaken down during a large earthquake.
We deal with hazards, we deal with risk, we deal with information, we deal with communicating that information to our communities in varying forms. Some of that information is quite technical, but obviously we need to provide information to all of our community, and trying to make those linkages between the technical boffins and detailed information, but making it sense for our communities, and essentially so that communities are informed. They're informed around their taiya, around their environment, and what immediate risks may be around the corner or further down the road. And I think that's really important around communities being able to make informed decisions when they need to.
Yeah, working in the geological environment and doing site investigations, etc., you come across a lot of geological hazards that are impinging on people's residence. They may have built a property on warm ground, and that warm ground is now impacting the stability of the building. The ground is collapsing or something like that, subsiding. The classic ones are building at the top or bottom of a cliff. There's many, many people, enjoy living at the top of a cliff because they get a spectacular view. But when a rainfall event or a climate event or an earthquake comes along and the cliff no longer stays there, their perspective of the view changes, same as the perspective for the poor guy at the bottom of the cliff. We see a lot of instances of what I perceive as poor planning. You have to really ask at the beginning of the conversation, why was the house built on the edge of a cliff? Why was it built at the bottom of a cliff? Why is it on a floodplain? Why is it in a geothermal area? A lot of it points back to understanding the hazards and having smart planning around how we utilise and mitigate those hazards. One of the things that I remember very, very vividly was the night of the following the Edgecombe earthquake. We got into the area quite late in the afternoon. The earthquake was at 1:30 in the afternoon, and we were trying to find the fault line that erupted, and we were trying to walk the fault and work out where it was. And doing that, we came across, parts of the rural community, and some of the properties and farms that we walked through, it was almost party mode. The people were really, really confident, really happy. And then the next property you walk through, they were really despondent, and the world had ended. And it took me ages before I sort of nutted it out and finally worked out what it was. At the end of the day, it was the barbecue. The people that were confident and happy were standing around a gas barbecue, or they might have been in a caravan or something like that. Their house was broken, they couldn't use the stove or anything. But they cranked up the barbie or cranked up the cooker in the caravan, and they'd had a hot meal. The other people that were despondent and really down on it, and also remembering that it started to rain that night, they had a cold can of spaghetti, and they'd hacked it open with a pocket knife, and they were eating it, cold can of spaghetti, and they were wet and cold. And for me, the lesson from that is gas cooker. my number one priority is a gas cooker. If I can cook myself a hot meal, I feel in control of my situation. I can go back into my house, I can go into the pantry. Okay, the pantry may well be on the floor, in fact it most likely will be, but I can still find the food, I can go to my deep freeze and get something. If I can cook it and have a hot meal, I'm in control and I'll feel good.
This was a Waikato Thing, Episode 4, Earthquake. Featuring, in order of appearance, GNS Science Geologist and Volcanologist Brad Scott, Waikato Regional Council Regional Resilience Specialist Whitney Mills, Waikato Regional Council Regional Resilience Team Leader Rick Liefting, GNS Science Paleoecologist and Earthquake Geologist Kate Clark, and Waikato Tainui's Rahui Pava. For more information, check out the links on our show notes page, waikatocivildefence.govt.nz/podcast. Produced and directed by Drew Mertens. Production partner, LeBlue. Copyright 2024, Waikato Civil Defence Emergency Management Group. Next, Tsunami.